part of the endless price being paid for the moral disaster of slavery, that the destruction of families had wrought irreparable damage carried from generation to generation. His opponent was shaking his head. The problem was never the enslavement of Africans. That's a myth, a politically correct fairy tale. The problem is simpler, uglier. The problem is Africans. Look at the facts. Millions of Africans were never enslaved. But Africa is still a total disaster. Every country, a disaster. Ignorance, illiteracy, lunacy, diseases, too disgusting to describe. Mass rapes, genocide. This isn't the result of slavery. This is the nature of Africa and Africans. The talking heads froze in place. Jagged triangles of color came swirling in from the edges of the screen, forming the letters of the words that earlier had blown apart. Explosive news happening now. See it all on Battleground tonight. There's nothing as real as Ram TV. Gelter nodded appreciatively before speaking, his eyes still on the screen.
Killer point about all the slavery bullshit, and he nailed the truth about the African cesspool. Refreshing to hear a man with the balls to tell it like it is.
Gurney shrugged.
Balls or a mental disorder?
Gelter said nothing, registering the remark only with a sharp sideways glance. The three-line statement on the screen blew apart again, and a single line coalesced from tumbling shards of color. The controversy continues. Then it too broke into pieces that cartwheeled out of the frame. A new talking head appeared, a young man in his early 20s with fine features, a fierce gaze, and thick reddish-blonde hair pulled back in a ponytail. His name and affiliation crept across the bottom of the screen. Corey Payne, White Men for Black Justice. Payne began in a strident voice.
The police claim to be defenders of the rule of law.
Gelter grimaced.
You want to hear a mental disorder? Listen to this, asshole.
They claim to be defenders of the rule of law, repeated Payne. But their claim is a lie. It's not the rule of law they defend, but the laws of the rulers, the laws of the manipulators, the ambition-crazed politicians, the dictators who want to control us. The police are their tools of control and repression, enforcers of a system that benefits only the rulers and the enforcers. The police claim to be our protectors. Nothing could be further from the truth.
Gurney suspected from the practiced flow of Payne's accusations that he'd made them many times before, but there didn't seem to be anything rehearsed about the anger driving them, or the intense emotion in the young man's eyes.
Those of you who seek justice, beware. Those of you who trust in the myth of due process, beware. Those of you who believe the law will protect you, beware. People of color, beware. Those who speak out, beware. Beware the enforcers who use moments of unrest for their own ends. This is such a moment. A police officer has been shot. The powers that be are gathering to retaliate. Revenge and repression are in the air.
You see what I mean? Unmitigated garbage.
Gelter was seething.
See what civilization is up against? The rabble-rousing crap that spews out of the mouth of that self-indulgent little shit.
He broke off as Trish came up to him, looking hurried and anxious.
You have a call on the house phone.
Take a message.
She hesitated.
It's Del Beckert.
There was a shift in Gelter's expression.
Well, I suppose I should take it.
After he'd disappeared through one of the doors in the back wall, Trish put on a bright smile.
I hope you like vegan Asian cuisine. I found the cutest young Cambodian chef, my little walk wizard.
7. They said little during the drive home. Madeline rarely spoke when they were in the car at night. For his part, he'd been making an effort not to be critical of social events she'd involved him in, and he could think of little positive to say about the party at the Gelters. As they were getting out of the car by the mudroom door, Madeline broke the silence.
Why on earth would they keep that television on all evening?
Postmodern irony, suggested Gurney.
Be serious.
Seriously, I have no idea why Trish would do anything. Because I'm not sure who she is. I don't think the packaging is particularly transparent. Marv might like to keep the TV on to keep himself angry and write about everything, bilious little racist.
Trish says he's a financial genius.
Gurney shrugged.
No contradiction there.
It wasn't until they were in the house and Gurney was starting to make himself a cup of coffee that she spoke again, eyeing him with concern. That moment when the officer was shot, were you all right?
More or less. I knew it had happened, so the video wasn't a total shock, just jarring.
Her expression hardened. News, they call it. Information. An actual murder on screen. What a way to grab an audience. Sell more ads. She shook her head. He assumed that part of her fury was indeed provoked by the profit-based hypocrisy of the media industry. But he suspected that most of it arose from a source closer to home. The horror of seeing a police officer, someone like her own husband, struck down. The price of her deep capacity for empathy was that someone else's tragedy could easily feel like her own. He asked if she'd like him to put on the kettle for some tea. She shook her head. Are you really planning to get involved in all of that? With some difficulty, he held her gaze. It's like I told you earlier, I can't make any decision without knowing more. What kind of information is going to make... The ringing of his cell phone cut her question short. Gurney here. Though he'd been out of NYPD homicide for 4 years, his way of answering the phone hadn't changed. The raspy, sarcastic voice on the other end needed no identification, nor did it offer any.
Got your message that you're looking for insider shit on White River. Like what? Give me a hint so I can direct you to the type of shit you have in mind.
Gurney was used to Jack Hardwick's calls, beginning with bursts of snide comments. He'd learned to ignore them. Sheridan Klein paid me a visit.
The slimebag DA in person? Fuck did he want?
He wants me to sign on as a temporary staff investigator.
Doing what?
Looking into the cop shooting. At least, that's what he says.
There's some reason the regular White River PD Detective Bureau can't handle that.
Not that I know of.
Why the hell's he getting involved in the investigation? That's not his turf. And why you?
That's the question.
How'd he explain it?
City on the verge of chaos, need to make solid arrests fast, pull out all the stops, no time for turf niceties, full assets into the breach, the best and the brightest, etc. Hardwick was silent for a bit, then cleared his throat with disgusting thoroughness.
Odd pitch. Distinctive odor of horseshit. I'd be careful where I stepped if I were you.
And before I step anywhere, I want to know more.
Always a good idea, so what do you want from me?
Whatever you can find out fast. Facts, rumors, anything at all. About the politics, the shot cop, the department, the city itself, the old incident with Laxton Jones, the Black Defense Alliance, anything and everything.
You need all this yesterday.
Tomorrow will do.
You don't ask for much, do you?
I try not to.
Very fucking kind of you.
Hardwick blew his nose about an inch from the phone. Gurney wasn't sure whether the man had a perpetual sinus problem or just enjoyed producing unpleasant sound effects.
Okay, I'll make some calls. Pain in my ass, but I'm a generous soul. You free tomorrow morning?
I'll make myself free.
Meet me in Dillweed and Abelard's, 9:30.
Ending the call, Gurney turned his attention back to Madeline, recalling that she'd been in the middle of asking him something.
What were you saying before the phone rang?
Nothing that won't wait till tomorrow. It's been a long day. I'm going to bed. He was tempted to join her, but the questions on his mind about the situation in White River were making him restless. After finishing his coffee, he got his laptop from the den and set it on the table in the breakfast nook. He pulled up a chair and typed White River, New York into the browser. As he scrolled through the results, looking for articles he might have missed earlier in the day, a few items caught his eye. An article in the Times emphasizing the ongoing nature of the problem. Police officer's death deepens upstate racial divide. A shorter, punchier post article. Cop gunned down at BDA rally. A muted approach in the White River Observer. Mayor Shucker calls for calm. And then there was the all-out Ram promotional screamer. First blood drawn in race war. Cop shot dead as activist incites crowd. See it all on Battleground Tonight, streaming live at ramtv.org.
After skimming the articles attached to these headlines and finding nothing that he didn't know already, he scrolled on. When he came to a link to the official White River Municipal website, he clicked on it. It was a predictable presentation of city departments, budget data, upcoming events, area attractions, and local history. A section on career opportunities listed a job opening for a part-time waitress at the Happy Cow Ice Cream Shop. A section titled Community Renewal described the conversion of the defunct Willard Woolen Socks Factory into the Winter Goose Artisanal Brewery. There were pictures of clean but deserted streets, red brick buildings, and a tree-shaded park named after Colonel Ezra Willard of the sock manufacturing family. The first of the two Willard Park photos showed a statue of the eponymous colonel dressed in a Civil War uniform astride a fierce-looking horse. A biographical note below the photo described him as a White River hero who gave his life in the Great War to preserve the Union. The second park photo showed two smiling mothers, one white and one brown, pushing their giddy toddlers on adjacent swings. Nowhere on the website was there any reference to the fatal shooting or the hate-driven violence tearing the city apart. Nor was there any mention of the correctional facility that provided the area with its main source of employment. The next item that attracted Gurney's attention was a section devoted to White River on a site called Citizen Comments Unfiltered. The site seemed to be a magnet for racial attacks posted by individuals with IDs like Truth Teller, White Rights, American Defender, and End Black Lies. The posts went back several years, suggesting that the city's overt racial animosities were nothing new. They brought to mind a wise man's comment that few things on earth were worse than ignorance, armed and eager for battle. He returned for a moment to the section of the White River website that showed the park and the statue of Colonel Willard, wondering if that might be the statue that Madeline had told him was one of the objects of the current protests. Finding nothing there that answered the question, he decided to do an internet search, trying various combinations of terms. Ezra Willard, Civil War, Statue, New York State, White River, Racial Controversy, Correctional Facility, Willard Park, Union, Confederacy. Finally, when he added the term slavery to the mix, he was led to the answer in the journal of one of the Civil War historical societies. The article was about the federal fugitive slave laws that legalized the capture in the North of slaves fleeing from slave owners in the South. Among the examples given of this practice was the establishment in 1830 by the mercantile Willard family of upstate New York of a detention facility to house captured runaway slaves, while payments were negotiated for their return to their southern owners. A footnote indicated that this lucrative practice ended when the war began, that at least one family member, Ezra, ended up fighting and dying on the Union side, and that after the war, the former detention site became the core of what was gradually rebuilt and expanded into a state prison, now the White River Correctional Facility. Pondering the ugly nature of the seed from which the institution had grown, Gurney could understand the impulse to protest the memorialization of a Willard family member. He searched the internet for more information about Ezra, but could find nothing beyond brief news references to BDA demands for the removal of his statue. Putting the historical issue aside, he decided to return his focus to getting as up-to-date as he could on the current turmoil. He revisited the RAM website in the hope that he might be able to extract some useful information from the opinionated noise they retailed as news and analysis. The site was slow in loading, giving him time to consider the irony of the Internet, the world's largest repository of knowledge having become a megaphone for idiots. Once it appeared, he clicked his way through a series of options until he reached the page titled Battleground Tonight, Live Stream. He was puzzled at first by what he saw on the screen. A close aerial view of a police car with siren blaring and lights flashing, speeding along a thoroughfare. The angle of the shot indicated that the camera was above and behind the cruiser. When the cruiser made a fast right at an intersection, so did the camera. When it came to a stop in a narrow street behind three other cruisers, the camera slowed and stopped, descending slightly. The effect was similar to a tracking shot in a movie chase scene. He realized that the equipment involved must be a sophisticated drone equipped with video and audio transmitters.
As the drone maintained its position, its camera slowly zoomed in on the scene the cruiser had been racing to. Helmeted cops were standing in a semicircle around a black man who was leaning forward with his open hands against the wall of a building. As the two cops from the cruiser joined the others, the man was handcuffed. A few moments later, after he was pushed into the back of one of the original cruisers, a line of text crawled across the bottom of the screen. 10:07 p.m. Dunster Street, Grinton Section, White River. Curfew violator taken into custody. See details on next RAM News Summary. As the cruiser pulled away, the video switched to a new scene. A fire engine in front of a smoldering brick building. Two firemen in protective gear holding a hose and directing its powerful stream through a shattered ground floor store window. A worn sign above the window identified the burned-out remains as Betty B's Barbecue. The camera's elevated point of view was similar to that of the first camera, indicating that its source was a similar high-end drone. It would seem, Gurney noted with interest, that RAM was applying significant resources to its coverage of White River. The next video segment was a street interview between a mic-wielding female reporter and a large fireman, whose black helmet displayed in gold letters the word Captain. The reporter was a slim, dark-haired woman whose expression and voice projected great concern.
"I'm Marilyn Mays, and I'm talking to Fire Captain James Pelt, the man in charge of the chaotic scene here on Bartle Boulevard."
She turned toward the big man, and the camera zoomed in on his jowly, ruddy-skinned face.
"Tell me, Captain, have you ever seen anything like this before?"
He shook his head.
"We've had worse fires, Marilyn, worse in terms of the heat and the combustion of toxic materials, but never in conditions like this, never this wantonness of destruction. That's the difference here, the wantonness of it."
She nodded with professional concern.
"It sounds like you've concluded that these fires are the intentional work of arsonists."
"That's my preliminary conclusion, Marilyn, subject to analysis by our arson investigator, but that's what I would say the conclusion would be."
She looked appropriately appalled.
"So what you're telling us, Captain, is that these people, some of these people, I should make that clear right now that we're talking about just a percentage, the law-breaking percentage of the population, some of these people are burning down their own neighborhood, their own stores, their own homes."
"Doesn't make a darn bit of sense, does it? Maybe the whole idea of sense isn't part of the thinking here. It is a tragedy. Sad day for White River."
"All right, Captain, we thank you for taking the time to talk to us."
She turned to the camera.
"Interesting comments from Captain James Pelt on the insanity and tragedy of what's happening in the streets of this city. I'm Marilyn Mays, reporting live for Battleground Tonight."
The scene shifted back to the earlier Talking Heads format. As before, the video was partitioned into three sections. A female news person now occupied the center position. She reminded Gurney of a certain kind of girl on a cheerleading squad. Blonde hair, straight nose, wide mouth, and calculating eyes. Every word and gesture a tactic for success. She spoke with a cool smile.
"Thank you, Marilyn, for that thought-provoking exchange with Captain Pelt. I'm Stacy Kilbrick in the RAM News Analysis Center with two high-powered guests with colliding points of view. But first, these important messages."
The video went black. With keywords flashing in bold red type against the dark background, an ominous voice intoned over the rumble of distant explosions. "We live in dangerous times, with ruthless enemies at home and abroad. As we speak, conspirators are plotting to strip us of our God-given right to defend ourselves from those out to destroy our way of life." The voice went on to offer a free booklet revealing imminent dangers to American lives, values, and the Second Amendment. A second commercial promoted the unique importance of gold bullion as the most secure medium of exchange as our debt-ridden financial system approaches collapse. An ancient anonymous authority was quoted, "Wisest of all is the man whose treasure is in gold." A free booklet would explain it all. The commercial faded out and the video cut back to Stacy Kilbrick in the center section of the screen. On one side was a 30-something strong-featured black woman with a short afro.
On the other side was a slightly wall-eyed, middle-aged white man with short, sandy hair. Kilbrick's voice projected an artful balance of confidence and concern. "Our subject tonight is the growing crisis in the small city of White River, New York. There are conflicting points of view on what it's all about." A bold line of type moved across the bottom of the screen. "White River Crisis, Perspectives in Collision." She continued. "On my right is Blaze Lovely Jackson, the woman who was in the car with Laxton Jones 1 year ago when he was killed in a confrontation with a White River police officer. She's also a founding member of the Black Defense Alliance and a forceful spokesperson for the BDA point of view. On my left is Garson Pike, founder of ASP, Abolish Special Privileges. ASP is a political action group promoting the repeal of special legal protections for minority groups. My first question is for Ms. Jackson. You're a founding member of the Black Defense Alliance and an organizer of the demonstrations in White River, demonstrations that have now led to the death of a police officer. My question, do you have any regrets?" Since they were evidently in different studios and responding to each other via monitors, each participant was addressing the camera head-on. Gurney studied Blaze Lovely Jackson's face. Something inside her was radiating an almost frightening determination and implacability. She bared her teeth in a hostile smile. "No surprise that you have that a little back to front. Nothing new in that, with young black men getting killed all the time. Streets are full of black men's blood going back forever. Boys in water, rats biting babies, rotten houses full of their blood. Right here in our own little city, there's a big nasty prison full of black men's blood, even back to the blood of slaves. Now one white cop is shot, and that's the question you have? You ask how much regret I have? You don't see how you have that all back to front? You don't think to ask which came first? Was it black men shooting white cops, or was it white cops shooting black men? Seems to me you have a little sequence problem. See, my question is, where's the regret for Laxton Jones? Where's the regret for all them black men shot in the head, shot in the back, beat to death year after year, forever and ever, hundreds of years, for no good reason on God's earth? Hundreds of years and no end in sight. Where's the regret for that?" "That may be a subject for a larger discussion," said Kilbrick with a patronizing frown. "Right now, Miss Jackson, I'm asking a reasonable question raised by the senseless assassination of a community servant trying to maintain public safety at the BDA rally you organized. I'd like to know how you feel about the murder of that man." "That one man? You want me to push aside hundreds, thousands of young black men murdered by white men? You want me to push them aside so I can fill up with regret about this one white boy? And then tell you all about that regret and maybe how much I regret being responsible for a shooting I didn't have nothing to do with? If that's what you want, lady, I'll tell you something. You have no idea what world we're living in. And there's something else I'll tell you right here to your pretty face. You have no damn idea how damn crazy you are." Along with Stacy Kilbrick's ongoing frown, there was satisfaction in her eyes. Perhaps the satisfaction of achieving the ram goal of maximizing the controversy in every situation. She moved on with a brief smile. "Now for a different perspective, Mr. Garson Pike. Sir, your viewpoint on the current events in White River?" Pike responded with a shake of his head and a long-suffering smile.
Perfectly predictable tragedy. Cause and effect. Chickens coming home to roost is the price we all pay for years of liberal permissiveness, price for political correctness."
His accent was vaguely country. His gray-blue eyes blinked with each small stutter.
"These jungle attacks on law and order are the price of cowardice."
Kilbrick urged him on. "Could you elaborate on that?"
"Well, our nation has been on a path of reckless accommodation, giving in again and again to the demands of every minority race, black, brown, yellow, red, you name it, lying down like doormats for invading armies of mongrel freeloaders and terrorists, giving in to the demands of the cultural saboteurs, the atheists, the abortionists, the sodomites. It's the terrible truth, Stacy, that we live in a country where every vile perversion, and every worthless segment of society has its champions in high places, its special legal protections. The more detestable the subject, the more protection we give it. The natural result of this surrender is chaos. A society turned upside down, the maintainers of order are attacked in the street, and their attackers pretend to be victims. The inmates, Stacy, have taken over the asylum. We're supposed to be politically correct, while all they do is complain about their minority disadvantages? Hell, like what? Like being put front of the line for jobs, promotions, special minority protections, and now they complain that they're disproportionately represented in prisons? Simple reason is that they're disproportionately committing the crimes that put them there. Eliminate black crime, and we pretty much have no crime in America at all. He concluded with an emphatic little nod and fell silent. The emotional momentum that had been increasing through his speech left little ticks tugging at the corners of his mouth. Kilbrick limited her reaction to a thoughtful pursing of her lips. "Ms. Jackson, we have about a minute left if you'd care to offer a brief response." Blaze Lovely Jackson's gaze had hardened. "Yeah, I'll be brief. That pike babbles the same fascist crap you Ram folks been feeding all these years to your trailer trash fans. I'll tell you what it really is. What you're doing is disrespectful. The white man is always making the black man feel small, like he's got no power at all, feel like he's no kind of man. You don't give him any decent job, then you tell him he's worthless because he ain't got a decent job. I tell you what that is, that's the sin of disrespect. Hear me now, even if you don't hear another thing, disrespect is the mother of rage, and rage is the fire that's going to burn this country down. Laxton Jones had no drug, no gun, no warrant, hadn't broken any law, hadn't done any crime. The man hadn't done nothing to nobody, but he got shot anyway, got shot dead in the face. How often do police do that to a white face? How often do they kill a white man who hasn't done a crime? You want to understand the true place we're at? You want to understand what BDA is all about? You think on that."
Kilbrick's eyes were alive with excitement.
"Well, there you have it. Two sides of the White River crisis in head-on collision on battleground tonight. We move now to our cameras on location, your eyes on the tense streets of White River. I'm Stacy Kilbrick, on the watch for breaking news. Stay with us."
The studio scene was replaced by an aerial shot of the city. Gurney could see smoke pouring from the roofs of three buildings. Orange flames shot up from one of them. On the main boulevard, he noted a procession of police cars, a fire engine, and an ambulance. The aerial camera was picking up the sounds of sirens and bullhorns. Gurney eased his chair back from the table as if to distance himself from what he was seeing on his computer screen. The cynical conversion of misery, anger, and destruction into a kind of reality TV show sickened him. And it wasn't just Ram. Media enterprises everywhere were engaged in the continual promotion and exaggeration of conflict, a business model based on a poisonous insight. Dissension sells. Especially dissension along the fault line of race. It was an insight with an equally poisonous corollary. Nothing builds loyalty like shared hatreds. It was clear Ram and its host of vile imitators had no qualms about nurturing those hatreds to build loyal audiences. He realized, however, that it was time to put aside grievances about which he could do nothing and focus on questions that might have answers. For example, might Blaze Lovely Jackson's rage at the police have been sufficient to involve her in actions beyond staging protests, actions such as planning, abetting, or executing the sniper attack? And why hadn't Klein gotten back to him? Had the query he'd left on the man's voicemail concerning the missing ingredient in their conversation scared him off? Or was the potential answer sensitive enough to demand long consideration, or perhaps even discussion with another player in the game? That thought led by a crooked route to another question that had been in the back of his mind ever since Marv Gelter had abandoned his party to take a call from Del Beckert. What sort of relationship did the racist billionaire have with the White River police chief? "Do you know if the upstairs windows are closed?" Madeline's voice startled him. He turned and saw her standing in her pajamas in the hallway that led to the bedroom.
The windows?
It's raining.
I'll take a look.
As he was about to shut down his computer, an announcement appeared on the screen in bold type. Crisis update. Live streaming press conference, 9 a.m. tomorrow, with Chief Beckert, Mayor Schucker, District Attorney Klein. He made a mental note of the time, hoping the event would be concluded before he had to leave for his meeting with Hardwick. Upstairs he found only one window open, but it was enough to fill the room with the flowery aroma of the spring night. He stood there for a while, breathing in the soft, sweet air. His racing thoughts were replaced by a primitive sense of peace. A phrase came to mind, something he'd once read. Just the phrase, emerging from an unrecalled context and attaching itself to the moment. A healing tranquility. Once again, as so often in the past, a pleasant and totally unanticipated consequence had followed from his doing a simple thing Madeline had asked him to do. He was sufficiently logic-driven to avoid attributing any mystical significance to these experiences, but their occurrence was a fact he couldn't ignore. When the wind shifted and the rain began to spatter lightly on the sill, he closed the window and went downstairs to bed. 8. Tranquility, unfortunately, was not his natural state of mind. During several hours of fitful sleep, his innate brain chemistry reasserted itself, bringing with it the low-level anxiety and uneasy dreams to which he was accustomed. At some point during those hours, he awoke briefly, discovering that the rain had stopped, a full moon had appeared behind the thinning clouds, and the coyotes had begun to howl. He went back to sleep. Another round of howling closer to the house woke him once more, from a dream in which Trish Gelter was ambling around a white cube in a field of daffodils. Each time she circled the cube, she announced, "I'm the fun one." A blood-covered man was following her. Gurney tried to clear the image from his mind and doze off again, but the persistent howling and the need to go to the bathroom finally got him out of bed. He showered, shaved, put on his jeans and an old NYPD t-shirt, and went to the kitchen to make himself some breakfast. By the time he'd finished his eggs, toast, and 2 cups of coffee, the sun was rising above the pine-topped eastern ridge. When he opened the French doors to let in the morning air, he could hear the chickens making their morning clucking noises out in the coop by the apple tree. He stepped onto the patio and for a while watched the goldfinches and chickadees visiting the feeders that Madeline had set up next to the asparagus patch. His gaze moved across the low pasture to the barn, the pond, and the site of his exploratory dig. When he discovered the buried foundation, accidentally, while clearing large rocks from the trail above the pond, and had exposed enough of it to get a sense of its antiquity, it had occurred to him that he might invite Dr. Walter Thrasher to have a look. In addition to being county medical examiner, Thrasher was an avid historian and collector of colonial artifacts. At the time, Gurney had wavered on whether to involve him, but now he was inclined to do so. The man's insights into the remains of the old house could be interesting, and having a personal avenue of access to him might prove useful if Gurney decided to accept Klein's invitation to step into the White River investigation. He went back into the house, got his phone, and returned to the patio. He scrolled through his list of numbers, found Thrasher's, and tapped on it. The call went to voicemail. The recorded announcement was nearly as short as Hardwick's. Rather than gruff, though, the tone was refined. It invited the caller to simply leave a name and number, but Gurney decided to include some details. "Dr. Thrasher, this is Dave Gurney. We met when you were the medical examiner on the Mellory homicide. Someone mentioned then that you were an expert on the colonial history and archaeology of upstate New York. I'm calling because I've uncovered a site on my property that may date back to the 18th century. There are a variety of artifacts, a flesher tool, ebony-handled knife, iron chain links, plus possible human remains, a child's teeth, if I'm not mistaken. If you'd like to know more about this, you can reach me on my cell anytime." Gurney added his number and ended the call. "Are you talking to someone out there?" He turned and saw Madeline at the French doors. Her slacks and blazer outfit reminded him it was one of her work days at the mental health clinic. "I was on the phone." I thought maybe Jerry had arrived. She's picking me up today. She stepped out onto the patio, raising her face into the slanting morning sunlight. I hate the idea of being cooped up in an office on a day like this.
You don't have to be cooped up anywhere. We have enough money to... She cut him off.
I don't mean it that way. I just wish we could see our clients outdoors in weather like this. It would be better for them, too. Fresh air, green grass, blue sky, good for the soul. She cocked her head. I think I hear Jerry coming up the hill. A few moments later, as a yellow VW Beetle made its way up the weedy lane through the low pasture, she added, You're going to let the chickens out, right?
I'll get to it.
She ignored the edge in his voice, kissed him, and headed out past the asparagus patch just as her exuberant fellow therapist, Geraldine Merkel, lowered her car window and cried,
Andiamo, the maniacs await us!
She winked at Gurney.
I'm referring to the staff.
He watched as they drove bumpily through the pasture, around the barn, and out of sight onto the town road. He sighed. That resistance in his response to Madeline's chicken reminder was childish, a silly way of trying to be in control when there was no reason for delay. His first wife had complained that he was a control freak. In his early 20s, he couldn't see it, but now it was obvious. Madeline generally had no reaction to it other than amusement, which made it feel even more childish. He went out to the henhouse and opened the little door into the fenced-in run. He tossed some commercial chicken feed, corn kernels, and sunflower seeds onto the ground, and the four hens came running out and started pecking at it. He stood there for a moment, observing them. He doubted he would ever be as fascinated by them as Madeline was. A few minutes before 9, he sat down at the breakfast table, opened his laptop, and went to the live stream section of the RAM website. As he was waiting for the promised press conference to begin, his phone rang. The number on the screen was vaguely familiar.
Gurney here. This is Walter Thrasher. You've discovered something of historical importance.
Your judgment on that would be sounder than mine. Would you be interested in taking a look at the site?
Did you say something about teeth and a black-handled knife?
Among other things, pieces of chains, hinges, a glass jar.
Pre-revolution?
I think so. The foundation is Dutch-style laid stone.
Not dispositive by itself?
I'll take a look. Tomorrow, early morning, that work for you?
I can make it work.
See you then, assuming nobody else on my turf gets shot in the meantime.
Thrasher ended the call first with no goodbye. As the RAM news anchor was announcing that the press conference was about to begin, a line of bold type crawled across the bottom of the screen. Officials reveal shocking new developments. The scene shifted from the anchor, with her hybrid expression of steadiness and concern, to three conservatively suited men at a table facing the camera. In front of each was a tent card bearing his name and title. Mayor Schucker, Chief Beckert, District Attorney Klein. Gurney's attention was drawn to Beckert, a casting director's fast-tracked Marine general. In his mid-40s, lean and square-jawed with an unblinking gaze, salt-and-pepper hair and a crisp military crew cut, he was the group's clear center of gravity. Mayor Schucker was a corpulent man with pudgy lips, suspicious eyes, and a comb-over dyed the color of rust. Klein, on the other side of Beckert, looked more conflicted than ever. The determined set of his mouth was belied every few seconds by tiny tremors that reminded Gurney, rather fancifully, of those minuscule vibrations along the San Andreas Fault that create shimmers of unease on the surface of still water. Crisis update began to flash repeatedly on the screen, and the camera moved in on Beckert. When the blinking phrase disappeared, he began to speak. His voice was clear, dry, unaccented. There was also something familiar about it that Gurney couldn't quite place.
1 hour ago, the White River Police Department Special Weapons and Tactics Unit carried out a successful assault on the headquarters of the Black Defense Alliance. Pursuant to appropriate warrants, the premises have been secured and are currently being searched. Files, computers, phones, and other potential evidentiary materials are being gathered for forensic examination. 14 individuals have been arrested at the location on charges including felony assault, harassment, obstruction, drug possession, and weapons violations.
This process is being conducted pursuant to our receipt of credible information regarding the shooting death of Patrol Officer John Steele. Be assured that our full investigatory resources are being applied to the apprehension of those responsible for the heinous murder of one of White River's finest officers, a man who earned my deepest respect and admiration. He lowered his head for a respectful moment before going on. I have an important request. Two high-ranking members of the BDA organization, Marcel Jordan and Virgil Tooker, were observed leaving the Willard Park demonstration just half an hour prior to the shooting of Officer Steele. We are eager to ascertain their whereabouts at the time of the shooting. We also have reason to believe that these same individuals slipped away from BDA headquarters prior to this morning's raid. It's vital that we find these two men. If you know where they are, or have information that could lead us to them, please call us any time, day or night. An 800 number began flashing on the screen next to the words Police Hotline, as Beckert continued. This savage attack on civilized society will be met with all necessary force. We will not allow jungle law to triumph. We will do whatever it takes to end this anarchy. I promise you, order will prevail. Concluding with a gaze of fierce determination, Beckert turned toward Shucker. Mayor, you have a few words for us? Shucker blinked, looked down at a sheet of paper in his hands, then back up at the camera. First, Mrs. Steele, my condolences for this tragedy. He looked down again at the paper. But those who set out to terrify our community with wanton violence and attack the heroes who protect us are the worst kind of criminals. Their reprehensible acts must be halted to restore peace to our wonderful city. Our prayers go out to the Steele family and to White River's brave protectors. He folded his sheet of paper and looked up. God bless America. Beckert turned toward Klein. Sheridan. The district attorney spoke with iron resolve. Nothing challenges the rule of law like an attack on the men and women sworn to uphold it. My office is applying the full weight of its resources to a thorough investigation, the discovery of the truth and the achievement of justice for the Steele family and for our whole community. The video cut to the female news anchor. Thank you, gentlemen. Now we go to our follow-up questions from the RAM issue analysis team. The video cut back to the three men at the table as questions were posed by off-camera voices. First male voice. Chief Beckert, are you suggesting that Jordan and Tooker are the prime suspects in the sniper shooting? Beckert replied expressionlessly. They're definitely persons of interest in our investigation. Second male voice. Do you consider them fugitives? Beckert, in the same flat tone. We have a high degree of interest in finding them. They have not come forward, and their whereabouts are currently unknown. First female voice. Do you have evidence of their involvement in the shooting? Beckert, as I said, we have a high degree of interest in finding them. We are focusing significant resources on that objective. Same female voice. Do you think Jordan and Tooker were tipped off prior to the raid? Beckert, a reasonable person might reach that conclusion. First male voice. What's your plan for addressing the ongoing chaos? Fires are still breaking out in the Grinton area. Beckert. Our plan is full force pushback. We will not tolerate disorder or anyone who threatens disorder. For anyone tempted to use political protest as a cover for looting, burning, hear this. I have instructed my officers to use lethal force wherever necessary to protect the lives of our law-abiding citizens. Another male voice asked Chief Beckert if his SWAT team had encountered armed resistance by BDA members. He replied that weapons were present during the operation, and more facts would be released after the filing of formal charges. The same voice asked if injuries had been sustained on either side of the confrontation. As Beckert was giving another, more information later, non-answer, Gurney noted the time on his computer screen. It was 9:15. Meaning he needed to leave for his 9:30 meeting with Hartwick. Although he was curious about what might be revealed during the remainder of the press conference, he knew RAM programming was continually archived for later viewing. He closed his laptop, grabbed his phone, and headed for the Outback. 9. Formerly a creaky old country store with a distinctly musty smell, Abelard's had been taken over by a transplant from the Brooklyn art scene by the name of Marika. An abstract expressionist, she was an intense 30-something woman with a dramatic figure she wasn't shy about showing off, numerous piercings and tattoos, and a startling array of hair colors. When she wasn't painting or sculpting, she'd been gentrifying the place. She'd removed the live bait cooler and the displays of turkey jerky. She'd sanded and refinished the wideboard floors. She'd installed a new cooler full of things organic and free-range, a bin for locally baked breads, a high-end espresso machine, and four funky cafe tables with hand-painted chairs. The hammered tin ceiling, pendant globe light fixtures, and rough-hewn shelving had been left intact. Gurney parked next to Hardwick's classic muscle car, a red 1970 GTO. As soon as he entered the store, he spotted Hardwick sitting in the back at one of the little round tables. He was wearing the black T-shirt and black jeans that had become his de facto uniform ever since he'd been forced out of the state police for offending his superiors too many times. This combative man with the pale blue eyes of an Alaskan sled dog, a razor-keen mind, a sour wit, and a fondness for obscenity was definitely an acquired taste, one you could almost get to like if you didn't choke on it first. His muscular arms were resting on the table, which seemed too flimsy to support them. He was talking to Marika, who was laughing. Her hair that day was a spiky patchwork of iridescent pink and metallic blue. "Coffee?" she asked when Gurney arrived at the table. Her striking contralto voice always got his attention. "Sure, double espresso." With an approving nod, she headed for the machine. He took the chair opposite Hardwick, who was watching her departure. When she disappeared behind the far counter, he turned to Gurney.
"Sweet girl, not as bad shit as she looks. Or half as bad shit as you are, if you're planning to get involved in that White River insanity."
"Bad idea?" Hardwick uttered a grunt of a laugh, picked up his mug of coffee, took a long sip, and laid it down with the care one might give an explosive.
"Too many virtuous people involved. All with high opinions of their own visions of justice. Nothing in this world worse than a pack of crazy fuckers who know, absolutely know, they're right."
"You referring to the Black Defense Alliance?"
"They are part of it, but only part. Depends on what you want to believe."
"Tell me more."
"Where should I start?"
"With anything that would explain Klein's desire to get me involved." Hardwick thought for a moment.
"That would probably be Del Beckert."
"Why on earth would Beckert want me involved?"
"He wouldn't. What I mean is Beckert might be Klein's problem."
Before going on, Hardwick made a face like the subject had a bad taste.
"I know what the fucker was like when I worked with him 10 years ago in the Bureau. That was before he became the big deal he is today. But even then, he was on his way. See, that's the thing. Beckert is always on his way to something. Eye on the goal. He's got that win-at-any-cost fixation that has a way of turning people into scumbags."
"From what I've heard, his reputation is more law and order than scumbag."
"And like a lot of high-class scumbags, he's good at nurturing and polishing that reputation. Beckert has an instinct for turning everything to his advantage, even negative shit. Maybe I should say especially negative shit."
"Like what?"
"Like his family life. Back then it was a fucking mess. His son, who was maybe 13 at the time, was a nasty little bastard. Hated his father. Did everything he could to embarrass him, painted swastikas on police cars, told Child Protective Services that his father was selling confiscated drugs. Then the kid tried to set fire to a Marine recruiting office, probably because his father had been a Marine. That's when Dad made his move. Sent the kid off to a super tough behavior modification boarding school somewhere down south. More like a prison than a school. And then..." Hardwick inserted a dramatic pause. Gurney stared at him.
"And then what?"
"And then Del Beckert revealed his true talent. He turned the whole stinking pile of crap into gold. Most cops try to keep their domestic problems private, but Beckert did the opposite. He spoke to parent groups, gave media interviews, appeared on talk shows, got well known within the world of parents with shithead kids. The tough love cop who did what had to be done. And when his painkiller-addicted wife died about a year later of a heroin overdose, he even turned that into a plus. He became the drug-fighting cop whose zero-tolerance attacks on drug dealers came from the heart, from his own painful experience."
Gurney was getting a bad taste in his mouth.
Sounds like a formidable character. Cold as they come, but he's managed to position himself as the perfect hard-ass cop every white citizen can love and vote for.
Vote for?
There hasn't been any official statement, but the Blue Grapevine says he'll be running for state attorney general in the special election.
And Klein mentioned the same rumor.
It would be the perfect next star on his precious resume.
Marek had delivered Gurney's double espresso. Hardwick continued.
That resume, by the way, is fucking impressive. Highest score in every NYSP promotion exam he took. After a few hot shit years in the Bureau, during which he picked up a master's degree in public administration, he took over the top spot in the professional standards unit. Then he moved into the private sector and set up a consulting organization to work with police departments around the state, assessing the psychological status of cops involved in violent confrontations, counseling them, and educating department brass on the nature and causes of violent incidents.
How'd that work out?
Great for Beckert. Hugely expanded his contacts in the law enforcement world.
But?
Legal activists claimed the purpose of his consulting was to help the police describe questionable incidents in ways that would minimize their exposure to criminal or civil actions.
Gurney took a sip of his very strong coffee.
Interesting. So how'd this rising star get to be police chief in White River? 3-4 years ago, just before you moved up here, there was a corruption scandal. The then-chief's phone was hacked and a lot of embarrassing shit came out. Seems that the chief, one of the captains, and three guys in the detective bureau were on the take from a gang running Mexican heroin into upstate New York. WRPD public relations disaster. Tried out for a new team, and what better guy than Beckert, with his professional standards background and hardline image to fumigate the place, reassure the citizenry, rebuild the department.
Another success?
Yeah, most people thought so. After dumping the tainted guys, he brought in his own people, allies from the state police and his consulting company.
Hardwick's jaw muscle twitched,
including a particularly close ally, Judd Turlock, who he installed as deputy chief.
How close, exactly?
Turlock went to the academy with him, reported to him in the bureau, and was his number two in the consulting outfit. They'd even been in the fucking Marines together.
You don't sound fond of this guy.
Difficult to be fond of a sociopathic attack dog.
Gurney considered this over another sip of coffee.
Is Beckert's tenure at White River being viewed as a success?
It depends on your point of view. He cleaned up the streets, put away a lot of drug dealers, reduced the number of break-ins, muggings, violent
crimes. But there have been some incidents. Right after he took over, a couple years before the Laxton Jones thing, there was a traffic stop that escalated into the beating and arrest of the young black driver, Nelson Tuggle. The cop claimed he found a handgun and a bag of coke under the front seat, and that Tuggle took a swing at him. Tuggle asked for a lie detector test. His lawyer got very aggressive with that, even got some media attention by publicly demanding that his client and the cop both be polygraphed. 2 days later, Tuggle was found dead in his cell. Heroin overdose, according to the ME. Got hold of some jail contraband, was how the COs explained it. A couple of street acquaintances said that was bullshit, that Tuggle might have done a little pot now and then, but no hard stuff.
Anyone pursue the case?
Tuggle had no family. There were no witnesses, no friends. Nobody gave a shit.
Is there a pattern? People claiming White River PD plays by its own rules?
And most of the convicted drug dealers claim exactly that. Of course, none of them can prove it. The judges and juries around here are overwhelmingly pro-cop. But the thing is, those popularity points Becker's been winning on the white side of White River, and he's been losing on the black side. It isn't that they don't want to get rid of the criminal element, but they have the feeling the man is playing God and dropping the hammer extra hard on black people to make a point.
So the pressure cooker's been heating up.
Big time. Unfortunately for Beckert, resentment that couldn't really be expressed in support of drug dealers found a perfect outlet in the case of Laxton Jones. The difference between Jones and Tuggle is that Jones wasn't alone. He had a girlfriend who witnessed what happened and was hell-bent to do something about it. Blaze Lovely Jackson.
I saw her on that Ram Battleground Tonight program. I'd say she's an angry woman.
Very angry, but also very smart. So there's some damn tricky days ahead for Beckert. Sinkholes he needs to avoid to get where he wants to go. You mean the Attorney General's office? And beyond? Fucker might even be picturing himself in the White House someday. That seemed a bit of a stretch, but who could say? The man did look the part, more so than a lot of nasty creeps with their eye on the top rung of the ladder. In fact, he had the kind of chiseled face that would be at home on Mount Rushmore. In the meantime, said Gurney, we have a sniper on the loose. Were you able to find out anything about Steele? Hardwick shrugged. Straight arrow, everything by the book, smart, college grad. Going to law school in his spare time, you want me to dig deeper? After a thoughtful pause, Gurney shook his head. Not yet. Hardwick regarded him curiously. So what's next? You signing up for the sniper hunt? I don't think so. If Klein is worried about Beckert's methods, that's his problem, not mine. So you're going to walk away? It seems like the sensible option. Hardwick flashed a hard, glittery grin. You mean you have no appetite for a clusterfuck in a dark closet? Shit, Gurney, you're saner than I thought.
10.
Gurney spent the drive home from Abelard's pondering what Hardwick had told him about Beckert, and convincing himself that backing away was, in fact, the sanest course of action. As he was getting out of the car by the side of the house, he could hear the landline phone ringing. He had some difficulty opening the mudroom door, stuck as it often was in warm weather, and by the time he got to the phone, a morose female voice was concluding a message with a callback number. He picked up the handset. Gurney here.
Oh, Mr. Gurney?
Yes.
This is Kim Steele, John Steele's wife.
He grimaced, picturing the TV image of the cop falling face down on the sidewalk. I'm terribly sorry, Mrs. Steele, terribly sorry. There was a long moment of silence. Is there something I can do for you? He asked.
Can I come and speak with you? I don't want to talk on the phone.
There was another silence, followed by what sounded to Gurney like a stifled sob.
I know where you live. I could be there in 25 minutes. Would that be okay?
He hesitated. Yes, it's okay. He ended the call, thinking immediately of 3 good reasons why no would have been a smarter answer. Putting aside his inclination to speculate on why the wife of a dead cop might want to talk to him or how she even knew he existed, he decided to use the intervening time to check the internet for any stories on the shooting that provided more than the bare-bones information he'd already seen. He went to the table in the breakfast nook where he'd left his laptop. Using the combination of Steele and White River, brought up links to Beckert's press conference, media reports on the incident, and opinion pieces from every point on the political spectrum, each purporting to explain the true causes of the violence. Nowhere did he find any details on the life of John Steele beyond the fact that he had a wife, now a widow. He decided to try entering the names John Steele and Kim Steele at various social media sites. He went first to Facebook. While he was waiting for the page to load, his attention was drawn to movement out beyond the French doors in the low pasture. He stood up just in time to see 3 white-tailed deer bounding through an opening in the ancient rock wall that separated the pasture from the woods. Assuming something had spooked them, he looked in the direction of the barn and pond. And there, at the end of the town road, another kind of movement. A glint of light, perhaps reflecting off a car or pickup truck, caught his eye. Whatever it was obscured by the big forsythia bush at the corner of the barn. He opened the door and stepped out onto the patio. But the situation was no clearer from there. He was about to walk down to the barn to satisfy his curiosity when the landline phone rang. He went back and checked the ID screen. It was Sheridan Klein.
Gurney here.
Hi, Dave.
Klein's voice was full of oily sincerity.
I'm responding to your message. The truth is, there are some sensitive details in this situation that wouldn't be appropriate for me to discuss with someone outside the official law enforcement circle. I'm sure you can understand that. But if you choose to step inside the tent on day 1, I'll make sure you know everything I know. and you'll have the best of both worlds here, official status plus independence from the bureaucracy. You'll be reporting only to me. That last promise was delivered as though it were a precious privilege. Gurney said nothing. Dave? I'm absorbing what you said. Ah, well, good. We'll leave it at that. The sooner you give me your answer, the better our chances of saving some lives.